Ladies and gentlemen, please welcome President and CEO, TV Alliance, Dr. Maria Freire. Executive Director, Campaign for Access and Essential Medicines, Médecins Sans Frontières, Dr. Tito von Schoen-Angerer. President, Global Health Program, Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, Dr. Tachi Yamada. And our moderator, Director, Center for Disease Control and Prevention, Julie Gerberding.
Well, good morning. I am absolutely honored to be part of this panel and to have a chance to sort of moderate this discussion, but I think you know our panelists don't really need that kind of moderation. This is really a strong hub of some of the most important and influential people in the world of solving infectious disease problems around the world, and people, I think, who are the kinds of opinion leaders who can really help us get to solutions. But, of course, we want to engage all of your good ideas in that process. So as you're listening to the panel this morning, you'll have questions. Please write them down. We'll be collecting them. And then when we return from the breakout session, we'll have a chance to address whatever issues you have that we might not have gotten to in the context of this panel. So I'd just like to start and give each of our panelists a chance to say one or two sentences about how they frame this problem. What really do they see as the most critical issues involving drug resistance in the three pathogens that are the focus of our discussion? Why don't we start with you, Tachi?
Well, I think the undeniable fact is that all medicines develop resistance. Evolutionary pressure on microbes forces in essentially the problem and makes us have to focus on continuing to develop a new pipeline of medicines and also to think very carefully about the importance of prevention. The best way to prevent resistance, of course, is to prevent the disease. But if you can't prevent the disease and you have treatment regimen. Often we've gone to multiple treatment regimens, that is multiple drug treatment regimens, and even under those circumstances, resistance always develops. So pipeline, new drugs are going to be needed in the future.
What is your perspective?
Well, I fully agree that development of resistance over time is inevitable, and the question is how can we delay it and deal with it. And in terms of HIV, we see is that even if we have perfect adherence of patients, of course, at some point you need to switch to a new therapy. And at the moment, we're very concerned how can we keep our patients alive and have access to the new line of medicines. But then if you look on TB, for example, I think we have a really worsening situation where we have increased multi-drug resistance. We have already dealt with that a lot in Eastern Europe, and now seeing that increasingly appearing in an HIV context in Africa is extremely worrying, and we don't have actually the right tools and strategies to deal with that efficiently. So I'll maybe later come back to that a little bit.
And Maria?
Well, we've been working, as you know. We now have our organization, and Tito and Tachi have helped us tremendously. So I'm going to focus on TB right now because it's the world I live in. In TB, resistance is essentially man-made, and we have to remember that. People don't know how to use these drugs. The drugs are sitting in docks and they don't get to the providers. We don't have fixed dose combinations in many contexts, so people mix and match and use different things. So horizontal transmission in TB is essentially not there. So we need absolutely what Tachi's been saying and what Tito's been saying. We need a pipeline of new drugs. My concern is twofold. My concern is that we lose sight that we really do have 2 million people dying of TB every year, 1.7 million people dying of just regular TB. and about 450,000 people of multidrug resistant tuberculosis. And that's, as Tito says, is a number that's increasing. So we have a real problem. Not only we have a real problem because we have a cadre of people with TB, and we have a cadre of people of those that are going to develop resistance. The second issue that's very important to remember is if we don't diagnose TB or if we don't diagnose resistance quickly and early, it's just simply going to continue to expand. So it has to take new drugs, and I think we're working on those. We can talk about that a little bit more. Tachi mentioned prevention, which are vaccines. The point of care diagnosis. We need to be able to immediately say you have a resistant strain, and we have to give you different kinds of medications.
So I think what you're all saying in different words is that these organisms have the capacity to evolve faster than we do as humans, or our pharmaceutical pipeline is evolving to develop new products to combat them. You've mentioned ultimately that the cure for resistance is prevention. Let's just spend 1 minute talking about the prospects for that, for vaccines, for TB, malaria, and HIV, and the prospects for expanding the drug pipeline. Where are we now and you know, say, in the 10-year outlook? What really is the lay of the land in terms of new pharmaceuticals and vaccines? So why don't we start with you, and if you have any perspectives on how that plays into the situation with malaria.
Well, I think some of the other panelists here know much more about the pipelines in a sense. But what we have seen is certainly a huge change over the last few years of renewed research and development activities in all the three disease areas. And that is great. And I think the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation have been a critical driver of that force. But when we then start to look at, is that enough? And is the pipeline solid enough? Will it be able to deliver? I think we realize it is still very weak. I mean, we just looked, we had a conference where TB Alliance really participated, and we saw, well, they've done really great work, but we need many more actors to come on and to make that pipeline probably double it, so we really have the new tools coming out. And I think that is a message across the board. What I wanted to highlight maybe around malaria, because you mentioned it, in terms of preventing and delaying, I think the inevitable resistance is really, I think, it's this chronic tension of you want to make the medicines as widely available as possible. And right now we have this newer artesamine combination therapies that are being rolled out, but with huge gaps and too slowly. And I really welcome the initiatives that are taking to look at and maybe have a subsidy, how you can make them more available also as almost like an over-the-counter medicine in pharmacies. But I think if we want to preserve this actually only really effective therapy today, we have to make sure we have diagnostics go along with it. And this is very simple. Rapid tests are available as a finger prick. And I think we need massive efforts to really make sure diagnostics goes along with it, because otherwise you have massive overuse. I mean, in South Sudan, for example, when we use diagnostics, we see is that actually only a third of the children that otherwise we would have treated for malaria actually have malaria. 10% only of the adults that otherwise would have been treated actually have malaria once you test it. So I think diagnosis, so you restrict the use for people that really need it, is critical to preserving the therapy.
Thank you. Let's just come back to this issue of the prevention pipeline and just get your perspectives on that.
Prevention for in the form of vaccines for malaria, the pipeline is relatively sparse. There's one late-stage vaccine, the RTSS vaccine by GSK, which is probably going into a late-stage clinical trial, phase two trials. It looked promising, but it didn't look really strong. There are seven other malaria vaccines in various stages of development right now. In the case of TB, there are six different vaccines that are going into phase two in the next year. The five of the six are actually based on BCG, sort of an improved BCG vaccine, one is not BCG, and they're going to be tested in four different clinical trials in some combination of priming and boosting. I think those pipelines are actually reasonably good, given how recently we started a massive investment in those efforts. The HIV vaccine pipeline, however, is one that concerns me more than anything. That is that you may have heard about the Merck trials, which failed last Thursday or Friday when the announcement was made. And so we've shown that a B-cell approach didn't work and a T-cell approach didn't work. And the question is, do we have the right antigen? Well, maybe. Or do we have the right combination? Do we have the right formulation? Do we have the right presentation? Do we have the right sequencing in the dosing and so forth? There's so many variables to look at, and we really need some very, very innovative approaches in the future, because we're into this 25 years now with HIV. Huge amounts of money have gone into HIV vaccine discovery and development, and we really have little to show for it.
So you're really saying we're not going to be able to vaccinate our way out of this problem anytime soon, and we've really got to grapple with where are we in the meantime when we're using drugs and we're driving resistance and the problem is really getting increasingly on everyone's radar screen. But as an infectious disease person, I've often been amazed at how complacent we are about infectious disease in general, particularly these three, but also the problem of drug resistance. What do we do to wake people up, to get the political will and the social will to really make these investments? Now, what are you thinking about that, Maria?
Well, I got to tell you, I started in TV 6 years ago. For anybody that works in a normal world, that's a long time. For people who have worked in TV, I'm a newcomer still. And the problem is that we become, as you say, complacent, and it's boring. My grandmother died of that. It doesn't exist. And a lot of these issues really don't touch us. I mean, the people in this room are here because these are the issues that touch you. I think we have to go and educate. So this is about forming partnerships and challenges, right? So why don't I throw out a challenge? We need to educate people around the world about resistance, and we need to educate people about how to take their drugs, and we need to educate physicians not to overprescribe antibiotics. So where are the PR agencies here? Where are the marketing people here? Help us. When we have a new vaccine, or when we have a new diagnostics, or when we have a new TB drug, which will happen, by the way, and I can talk about the synergies in a second, we need the best marketeers out there. We need the best forces to help us put these goods as if it were the blockbuster product that we're going to be putting out there. We've got to show the world that these are the cutting-edge technologies. We've got to show the political people that have the wherewithal to change the regimen, that this is where we want to go. So we're sitting here looking at this from a very pragmatic perspective. We need to develop it. We need to deliver it. We need to get it. We need a different layer. We need a layer of people that can galvanize action, because if we roll out a new antibiotic in one group of patients, resistance is going to happen, as Tachi says. And if we don't have a massive campaign for rollout and doing it responsibly, all the work of 10 years is going to go again for nothing. So this is very important.
Tachi. Yeah, I want to comment on this. This is really an interesting problem. If you have a resistance to TB, you're resistant to triple drugs. If you replace one of the drugs with a new antibiotic, then it's like single therapy because there's resistance to the other two. So that is a prescription for increased resistance to the new antibiotic. So the problem is with TB, you have to launch all three antibiotics in a new combination, or else each one of the ones you launch one at a time develop resistance. So in a way, this is I thought about this from my previous industry experience. When you launch a new product, let's say an iteration of a new product, the sales force goes out and replaces all the samples that were there for the old product and replace them with a new product. You get a complete switch overnight. That's what we need in TB. So if we get a new triple drug regimen, we have to be able to suddenly pull off everything on the shelf, take all the medicines away from the little kiosks that are selling the other drugs, and replace them with the new ones. So this is a pharmaceutical launch of major proportions. We're not going to be able to do this without the help of the industry. We're really going to need people who know how to do this. We're going to have to work through government and private sector retailers in order to be able to do the kind of switch we need if we're going to do a massive, effective switch to a new TB regimen. And this is something that we're only beginning to sort of work through as a not-for-profit sector when we think about even the prospect of success of all the investments we've made in new medicines.
We've been talking about some kind of top-down approaches or the macro level. Let's turn it around and think about it from the standpoint of individual patients or individual communities where these problems are emerging. I was in Africa recently, and since I was there a couple of years ago, I was impressed with how the market for cell phones has penetrated so deeply into so many communities, and it made me at least appreciate the power that technology could really bring in more innovative and creative ways to solve some of these problems. Do you see changes being wrought at the patient level or at the community level, and how can people here maybe engage or invest in some of these more innovative approaches to individual interest in treatment and individual access to treatment? Any perspectives from the panel?
Well, I think you're right with the perspective of mobile phone use, because people go straight from no phone to mobile phone. We have some experience to actually, I mean, if you give a patient a mobile phone and he's reachable, or he can call in when there's a problem, or you get the test result out. I mean, there are ways to use some newer technologies, that's for sure.
So we've done some studies on that, and we actually are forming what we call, I'm going to get this wrong, it's CAC. And I thought it stood for community, but the people wanted to make it constituency advisory committees to us. And these are the people on the ground, in the field, that are working with us to help us both with our clinical trials, but also with education and penetration. And what we find is, in fact, that there's always an elder in the community, or there's always an opinion leader, a gatekeeper in the community that is critical to be educated, and it's critical for the penetration of the new technology. So I can envision giving a mobile phone to that gatekeeper and having the people working with us.
Yeah. Is that something that you're working on through the Gates for the Grand Challenges? Well,
we are. We're thinking about exactly how to harness this mobile phone technology to enhance access to patients. I think where it's going to be really useful may not necessarily be in the initiation of therapy, but in pharmacovigilance. One of the big problems we have now is we've got all these patients out there being treated for HIV, and they're having complications. We just don't know about them. And when they go on second line, where the risks are even greater, my real concern is that this is going to become a raging problem, and we have no mechanism for pharmacovigilance. So I believe the phone technology is going to be critical for reaching the patients, for reporting events, for understanding what we have to do to certain subjects, certain patients that have the major problems and so forth.
No, in a typical environment where Dr. Mom in the hut is really worrying about water and just basic food and nutrition and sort of in a survival mode, are these infectious diseases on her mind? Have we really engaged citizens in these particular problems, or are we too far down the pipeline of worry to really have this be on their radar screen?
I'm sorry, are you asking about infectious diseases? I think
TB, malaria, and HIV,
and
in particular, the importance of diagnosis and treatment.
I think mothers are always worried about their sick children, and of course, malaria is high on their list. One of the reasons why there's overtreatment is because the presumption for any child with a fever is probably that it's malaria. And yet, maybe a bigger killer is pneumonia. And so the question is the right diagnostic. And maybe the right diagnostic is not necessarily a malaria diagnostic per se, but a fever of unknown origin diagnostic. So that I think would be the most useful point of care diagnostic. Whatever happens beyond that, I think obviously inexpensive tools for accurately diagnosing malaria and TB and pneumonia are very important.
I think we've talked a little bit about diagnosis and point of care diagnosis. Are we close? Is this something that we can see looking forward to in the next few years, or is this like vaccines a long way off?
Well, so there's three organizations attached at the hip here, and the hip usually is the Gates funding, I should say. We have an organization called FIND that works on diagnostics, started out specifically for TB, but it's broader, the TB Alliance, which develops the new combination of medicines, and ARIS that works on the TB vaccines. The good news is that we actually talk to each other. So we know, for example, that the people at FIND are right now doing a pilot study for diagnosing extremely drug-resistant or extensively drug-resistant tuberculosis in South Africa. Their goal is to have a point-of-care diagnostic by 2010, which is important then for us, the drug developers, because if we now can diagnose many more people and at point of care, then what happens when we say we don't have the drugs to treat you? And it becomes a real problem. Our expectation is that a completely new regimen that Tachi was talking about will probably come about, she says, with all high hopes, and this is very hard for a drug developer to say because we know it's difficult, but probably around 2012 to 2015. And we expect the first drug to be around 2015 to 2020. So these three groups really are engaged not only in galvanizing our own work, but in galvanizing the work of others that are working in tuberculosis. So there is some sort of perspective of how we go about doing these things.
Well, I mean, I should share a sense of frustration that we have in the field of and trying to treat, and it links very much to the situation of individuals and the families. I mean, if you look at how to treat multi-drug resistant TB, it's 18 to 24 months. You take the person out of his family, put him in a hospital, basically. A lot of toxic side effects, and if we as an organization put a lot of resources on it, we achieve to have a success rate of 55%, so only half of them. And it's basically, and that is in a setting where you don't have HIV. Now we have the problem that this is appearing in South Africa and Southern Africa in general, and frankly, I don't know how we're going to deal with this. I think we need to massively scale up the efforts. We already know there's going to be a shortage of the second line drugs in production. There's not enough suppliers. We need help to set up some of the bigger laboratories, because indeed, as you say, the tests are not simple enough, so we need to have a few more really strong laboratories. But I think we need to critically really change the whole, I mean, we need to create a sense of urgency. I mean, in the 80s with HIV, there we had a real sense of urgency, and there was a push. We needed to take risks and do everything possible to keep patients alive. And I don't see that happening in TB for the moment. I think we need to accelerate everything that we have in the pipeline today. I fully agree we need a better first-line therapy, but I don't think we can, or we're going to wait to have that ready, or because it's going to take time, and I think it's important that all the drugs that are in the pipeline today are also tested in multi-drug resistant patients, because if you can cut down that time by half or something, you saving lives, you make this people possible to sustain their families. And I know it's risky, but we have done it in HIV. I mean, we have taken risks. We started with monotherapy, with biotherapy, because we were so desperate to keep patients alive. And so that's, I think, what we need to do.
Thank you for that. We have about 5 minutes before we begin the breakout session, so I just want to remind you to be sure and write down any questions that you might have for the panel so that we have a chance to address them when we come back. Tachi.
One of the things I want to make a plea for, and there may be some industry people in the room, we need industry's help on this. In fact, when I was in the industry, and I first met Maria almost 5 years ago now, I tried to create an industry consortium for TB. I felt the urgency 5 years ago. And the idea I put on the plate was that we would all work on each other's scaffolds, molecular scaffolds, that we would share the IP, and that we would all throw it into the Global Alliance. I can get any take-up on this. Unfortunately, I did set up a laboratory at GSK that was focused on malaria and TB medicines. But the collaborative interaction from industry was not there, and it's needed now. It's not going to be one company that does it. Actually, we need multiple scaffolds in order to have a triple drug regimen for TB that is different from any component that we currently use. And my feeling is that we're going to have to work together to try to create that. Now, part of it will be depending on industry's goodwill, but goodwill only goes so far. So the other part is the creation of incentives. And incentives are what we're working on right now. What are the incentives that will drive this kind of behavior? Recently, you may have heard that the FDA bill was, the FDA reauthorization bill was just, I don't know where, how far it is. Is it gone through both houses of Congress? Right. My understanding is that there was one amendment in it that's very interesting, which was an amendment that says that if you work on or develop one medicine for the developing world, you get a credit for an accelerated approval of another medicine that you're working on. Is that right? I mean, I am told that that's an amendment in this bill. That's a spectacular amendment, because what it is that it gives industry an incentive to do this. We have to figure out these kinds of incentives, otherwise we're not going to get them to the table and help us. It's just not going to happen through simply academic labs.
When we were talking earlier, you mentioned that there's this market incentive, which is for the company as a whole to benefit in the marketplace, and that leaders often feel this passion, and often frontline employees do too. This is a generation where people are highly motivated by values. But there's a problem in the middle.
So I've been trying to cut deals, and I've been successful in cutting deals, as Tachi said. The urgency that we all feel, it was like walking into his office at GSK, and he had the seven heads of R&D for major pharma at the table. And the interesting thing to me is that they all absolutely agreed. Remember, Tachi? They all absolutely agreed. But when they went back to the companies, the story changed. And it isn't the scientists. The scientists love working in these problems. It's the middle management, because there is absolutely no incentive in them for them to put any of their budget, and their budget is very tightly controlled. There is no incentive for the business development people not to say, well, what if this is a blockbuster and I'm giving it for these diseases? So we really do have to work in changing that internal structure, or at least mentality, and give them the ability to be creative and innovative.
We're about to break, but before we do, I'm going to ask each panelist in 15 seconds or less to just say the one place that they think we could make the biggest difference now if we could engage a partner to really help provide a solution or to make a commitment of assistance. So what's the one area that would make the biggest difference in drug-resistant infectious diseases in the developing world today?
Well, clearly, as I said before, we have to have pipeline. In order to have pipeline, we definitely need industry partners. In order to have industry partners, we have to have the proper incentives. So this is the combination, and I'm very pleased to hear it that this new FDA reauthorization bill addressed that. I'm really pleased about the advanced market commitments and other such inducements, and we have to think very clearly about how we're going to do this.
So policy and market incentives. How about you, Tito?
Well, I really appreciate the industry of industry in this, and I think if you look at TV, there's really concrete things that different industry and private enterprise can contribute is in terms of helping to set up some of the laboratories that we need. I think helping us to figure out how can we tackle the shortage of the second line drugs. Who can produce them? Additional producers. How do we the market forecast?
One thing.
All right.
I agree with both of them. and sense of urgency. For me, it's the sense of urgency.
So you would say waking up the motivation, the action, really overcoming the apathy and the complacency. And you would say partnerships to develop the diagnostic pipeline as well as the treatment pipeline. And you would say policy and market forces to really incentivize the biggest levers to move this forward faster. Well, that's a good start for a conversation at the table, and I'll turn it over to our leader who will tell us the next steps.
Thanks very much. So we've just had mapped out for us some of the major challenges in this area of dealing with drug resistance, and our panelists have opened up some doors for us in terms of areas to be further explored for taking action. And, of course, the emphasis here in CGI is on action. So we want to engage your thinking in the question, what is it that can actually be done to address some of these challenges, to take advantage of some of these avenues that have been opened up for us? So what we'd like you to do at your tables is have a conversation amongst yourselves. Take the leadership position to say, what are actions that really can be taken that would really make a difference here? We'd like you to identify 2, 3, 4 actions during this next 25 minutes. Have a conversation about them and really, really hone in on the strategies that you think would make the biggest difference. Come up with not only what is the strategy, who should be involved in the strategy, and what would be a very concrete first step in being able to implement that strategy. And again, as you have that discussion, your facilitators will enter your ideas into the laptops. I want to assure you, every idea that's entered in here, whether they're reported back after the session or not, are captured for the record and are taken advantage of during the course of the next year in seeding other ideas for action. So we really do appreciate all your comments. The other thing I want to ask you to do is you were asked to generate questions to ask the panelists. If those have not already been entered into the laptops, please give them to your facilitator at the beginning of this conversation so we can get them and share them with the panelists and the moderator over the break. Have a great conversation, and we'll be back up here in 25 minutes.